Michael had explained to Andrew what he had in mind. "If you get caught, I will disclaim any knowledge of the whole nefarious scheme. I will, furthermore, put aside with great enjoyment at your court-martial, and will personally command the firing squad," Andrew warned him. Michael had paced out the firm ground at the edge of North Field on the side of the Detiri estate furthest from the squadron base. He had to slide-slip the bright yellow SE-5A down behind the line of oaks that guarded the field. And then, as he skimmed over the 7-foot stone wall, he shut the throttle and let her drop to the soft earth. He pulled up quickly and left the engine idling as he clambered out on the wing. Santan was running out from the corner of the wall where she had been waiting. He saw she had followed his instructions and was warmly dressed, fur-lined boots under her yellow woolen skirt and a yellow silk scarf at her throat. Over it all she wore a lustrous cape of silver fox fur, and the hood dangled down her back as she ran. She carried a soft leather bag on a strap over one shoulder. Michael jumped down and swung her in his arms.
"Look, I'm wearing yellow, your favourite."
"Clever girl." He sat her down. "Here." He pulled the borrowed flying helmet from the pocket of his greatcoat and showed her how to fit it over her thick dark curls and buckle the strap under the chin.
"Do I look gallant and romantic?" she asked, posing for him.
"You look marvellous." And it was true. Her cheeks were rouged with excitement, and her eyes sparkled. "Come on." Michael climbed back onto the wing and then lowered himself into the tiny cockpit.
"It's so small,"
Santan hesitated on the wing. "So are you. But I think you are also afraid, no?"
"Afraid?
Ha!" She flashed a look of utter scorn at him and began to climb in on top of him. This was a complicated business, which involved lifting her skirts above her knees and then balancing precariously over the open cockpit, like a beautiful bird settling on its clutch of eggs. Michael could not resist the temptation, and as she came down on top of him, he ran his hand up under the skirts, almost to the junction of luscious silk-clad thighs. Santan squealed with outrage.
"You are forward, monsieur?"
And she plopped down onto his lap. Michael fastened the safety belt over both of them and then nuzzled her neck below the edge of the helmet. "You are in my power now. You cannot escape."
"I'm not sure that I wish to," she giggled.
It took some further minutes for them to arrange all Santan's skirts and furs and petticoats and to make sure that Michael could manipulate the controls with her strapped onto his lap. "All set," he told her, and taxied to the end of the field, giving himself every inch of runway that he could, for the earth was soft and the strip short. He had ordered Mac to remove the ammunition from both guns and drain the coolant from the Vickers, which saved almost 60 pounds in weight, but still they were overloaded for the length of runway available to them. "Hold on," he said in her ear, and opened the throttle, and the big scout plane bounded forward. "Thank God for the south wind," he murmured, as he felt her unstick from the mud and strive mightily to lift them into the air. As they scraped over the far wall, Michael banked slightly to lift his port wing over one of the oaks, and then they were climbing away. He felt how rigid Santan was in his lap, and he thought she was really afraid. He was disappointed. "We are safe now," he shouted over the engine beat, and she turned her head and he saw in her eyes not fear, but ecstasy.
"It's beautiful," she said and kissed him.
To know that she shared his passion for flight delighted him. "We will go over the chateau," he told her, and banked away steeply, dropping down again. For Santan, it was the second most marvellous experience of her whole life. Better than riding or music, almost as good as Michael's loving. She was a bird, an eagle. She wanted to shout her joy aloud. She wanted to hold the moment forever. She wanted to always be on high, with the wild wind howling around her and the strong arm of the man she loved holding her protectively. Before her lay a new world, familiar places that she had known since her earliest childhood, now viewed from a different and enchanting dimension.
"This is the way the angels must see the world," she cried, and he smiled at the fancy.
The chateau loomed ahead of them, and she had not realized how big it was, or how pink and pretty was the roof of baked tiles. And there was Noirge in the field behind the stables, galloping ahead of them, racing the roaring yellow aircraft, and she laughed and shouted in the wind, "Run, my darling!" And then they passed over him, and she saw Anna in the gardens, straightening up from her plants as she heard the engine, shading her eyes, peering up at them. She was so close that Santan could see the frown on her red face, and she leaned far out from the cockpit. Her yellow scarf flowed behind her in the slipstream as she waved, and she saw the look of crumpled disbelief on Anna's face as they flashed by. Santan laughed in the wind and called to Michael, "Go higher! Go up higher!" He obeyed, and she was never still for a moment, twisting and hopping about in his lap, leaning out of the cockpit first on one side, then on the other. "Look, look! There is the convent! If only the nuns could see me now. There, that is the canal, and there is the cathedral in Arras. Oh, and there!" Her excitement and enthusiasm were infectious, and Michael laughed with her, and when she turned her head back to him, he kissed her, but she broke away. "Oh, I don't want to miss a second." Michael picked out the main Air Force bait at Bertangles. The runways formed a cross of mown green turf through the dark forest, with a cluster of hangars and buildings nestling in the arms of the cross. "Listen to me," he shouted in her ear. "You must keep your head down while we land." She nodded. "When I give you the word, jump down and run into the trees. You will find a stone wall on your right. Follow it for 300 meters until you reach the road. Wait there." Michael joined the Bertangle circuit in textbook fashion, taking advantage of his sedate downwind leg to scrutinize the base for any activity which might indicate the presence of high-ranking officers or other potential troublemakers. There were half a dozen aircraft parked in front of the hangars, and he saw one or two figures working on them or wandering about amongst the buildings. "Looks as though it's clear," he muttered, and turned crosswind and then on to final approach, with Santan scrunched down on his lap, out of sight from the ground. Michael came in high, like a novice. He was still at 50 feet when he passed the hangars, and he touched down deep at the far end of the runway and let his rollout carry them almost to the edge of the forest before he swung broadside and braked hard. "Get out and run," he told Santan, and boosted her out of the cockpit. Hidden from the hangars and buildings by the fuselage of the SE-5A, she hoisted up her skirts and tucked her leather bag under her arm and scampered into the trees. Michael taxied back to the hangars and left the SE-5A on the apron.
"Better sign the book, sir," a sergeant mechanic told him as he jumped down.
"Book?"
"New procedure, sir. All flights have to log in and out."
"Damned red tape," Michael grasped. "Can't do a thing without a piece of paper these days." But he went off to find the duty officer.
"Oh, yes, Courtney. There is a driver for you."
The driver was waiting behind the wheel of a black Rolls-Royce, parked at the back of number one hangar. But as soon as he saw Michael, he sprang out and stood to attention.
"Gossana," he grinned with huge delight,
his teeth gleaming in his dark moon-shaped face, and he threw Michael a sweeping salute that quivered at the peak of his cap. He was a tall young Zulu, taller even than Michael, and he wore the khaki uniform and puttees of the African Service Corps.
"Sangane," Michael returned the salute, grinning as widely, then impulsively hugged him.
"To see your face is like coming home again," Michael spoke easy, fluent Zulu. The two of them had grown up together, roaming the grassy yellow hills of Zululand with their dogs and hunting sticks. Naked, they had swum together in the cool green pools of the Tugela River and fished them for eels as long and thick as their arms. They had cooked their game on the same smoky fire and lain beside it in the night, studying the stars and seriously discussing the occasions of small boys, deciding on the lives they would live and the world they would build when they were grown men. "What news from home, Sangane?" Michael demanded as the Zulu opened the door of the rolls. "How is your father?" "Mbajane," Sangane's father, was the old servant companion and friend of Sean Courtney, a prince of the royal house of Zulu, who had followed his master to other wars, but was now too old and infirm, and was forced to send his son in his place. They chatted animatedly as Sangane drove the rolls out of the base and turned on to the main road. On the back seat, Michael stripped his flying gear to reveal his dress uniform, complete with wings and decorations, that he wore beneath. "Stop over there, Sangane, at the edge of the trees." Michael jumped out and called anxiously, "Santan?" She stepped out from behind one of the tree trunks, and Michael gaped at her. She had used the time since he had left her to good effect, and he realized now why she had brought the leather bag. Michael had never seen her wearing makeup before, but she had applied it so artfully that he could not at first fathom the transformation. It was simply that all her good points seemed enhanced, her eyes more luminous, her skin more glowing and pearly. "You are beautiful," he breathed. She was no longer a child woman. She was possessed of a new poise and confidence, and he felt awed by her. "Do you think your uncle will like me?" she asked. "He will love you. Any man would." The yellow suit was of a particular shade that seemed to gild her skin and throw golden reflections into her dark eyes. The brim of the billy cock hat was narrow on one side and full on the other, where it was pinned up to the crown with a spike of green and yellow feathers. Beneath the jacket, she wore a blouse of fine creamy crepe de chine with a high lace collar that emphasized the line of her throat and the dainty set of her small head above it. The boots had been replaced by elegant shoes. He took both her hands and kissed them reverently, and then handed her into the back of the limousine. "Sangane, this woman will be my wife one day soon." The Zulu nodded in approval, judging her as he would a horse or a young thoroughbred heifer. "Mishi beu mini sans," he said. When Michael translated, Santen blushed and laughed.
"Thank him, Michel, but tell him I would like at least one daughter."
She looked about the luxurious cab of the Rolls. "Do all the English generals have such motor cars?" "My uncle brought it from Africa with him." Michael ran his hand over the fine, soft leather seat. "It was a gift from my aunt."
"Your uncle has style to go to war in such a chariot," she nodded. "And your aunt has good taste. One day I hope I will be able to give you such a gift, Michel."
"I should like to kiss you," he said.
"Never in public," she told him primly, "but as much as you want when we are alone. Now tell me, how far is it?"
5 miles or so, but with this traffic on the road, God alone knows how long it will take us. They had turned into the main Arras-Amiens road, and it was clogged with military transport, guns and ambulances and heavy supply lorries, horse-drawn wagons and carts, the verges of the road crowded with marching men, hunchbacked beneath their heavy packs, with the steel helmets giving them a mushroom-headed uniformity. Michael caught resentful and envious glances as Sangane threaded the big, glistening rolls through the slower traffic. The men trudging in the mud looked into the interior and saw an elegant officer with a pretty girl on the soft leather seat beside him. However, most of those sullen stares turned to grins when Santan waved to them.
"Tell me about your uncle," she demanded, turning back to Michael.
"Oh, he's a very ordinary chap. Not much to tell, actually. He was thrown out of school for beating up his headmaster, fought in the Zulu War, and killed his first man before he was 18. Made his first £1 million before he was 25, and lost it in a single day. Shot a few hundred elephant while he was a professional ivory hunter, killed a leopard with his bare hands, then, during the Boer War, he captured Leroux, the Boer general, almost unaided, made another £1 million after the war, helped negotiate the Charter of Union for South Africa. He was a cabinet minister in Louis Botha's government, but he resigned to come out to this war. Now he commands the regiment. He stands a few inches over 6 feet and can lift a 200-pound sack of maize in each hand.
"Michel, I'm afraid to meet such a man," she murmured seriously.
"Why on earth? I'm afraid
I might fall in love with him."
Michael laughed delightedly. "I also am afraid. Afraid he will fall in love with you."